All right. Anybody remember what we talked about 2 months ago? Because last month we met with the other churches, so it was something different. Anybody remember what we talked about 2 months ago?
We were going to talk about the virtues.
Okay. Yeah. So 2 months ago was kind of an introduction to the virtues. And there are four what are called cardinal virtues. And the cardinal just comes from the Latin cardo, which means hinge. So they're the virtues on which all other virtues hinge. And then there are three theological virtues. And C.S. Lewis put it as the four cardinal virtues are those that every civilized group of people know about, but the theological virtues are those only Christians know about. So just as a refresher, what are the four cardinal virtues? Okay, prudence is one.
Courage.
Yep. Its classical name is fortitude.
Temperance.
Good. It's also known as self-control. Classical name is temperance. What's the last one? Justice. Also known as justice. That one doesn't really have another name. So, yeah, prudence, temperance, fortitude, and justice. And then what are the three theological virtues?
Love,
faith, and hope. Okay, faith, hope, and love. Those are the three theological virtues. Does anybody remember, I gave a shorthand definition of what virtue is 2 months ago. Does anybody remember what that is? It's no slam on you if you don't remember. So I said the way that, just as a shorthand to think of it, is that virtue is effortless good. Okay, it's effortless good. It's not something you have to work yourself up to. If you're working yourself up to doing the good, that's fine. It just means that it's not a virtue yet. A virtuoso is somebody who plays something really without flaw. Okay, and so to have a virtue is to be able to effortlessly enact that virtue. And kind of where we were going with this is that the proper end of a human being is Jesus Christ himself. He is the fully obedient human being, and as we're being sharpened into Christ-likeness, we become more and more excellent men. We become more and more in his likeness. And one of the things I said last time, too, is that the primary tool that you have to deal with the world is yourself. That's the primary tool that you have in your life is yourself. And so wherever you go, there you are. And that's what you bring to every situation that you're in. You are what you have to work with. Okay, and so it's upon us to become better and better, more excellent men. And we're being made into the kind of men who can enact effortless good. So let's see, we talked about the four cardinal virtues, and the first of these that we're going to talk about is prudence, which is also known as wisdom. I like the classical names, so I'm gonna usually use prudence throughout. And just a quick caveat on this, you know, there are a lot of ways, there's no way to be exhaustive this morning in talking about prudence. And I could share how prudence has been classically understood, how Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas and their interpreters have understood wisdom and lay that out. But frankly, I don't think you'd find it very interesting. And so I think it would be better to try to share images and stories that kind of make it a little bit more concrete, because wisdom lives out in the wild and is better understood, I think, by examples. So I'm going to mostly share the sources, the scriptures, the stories that have helped me understand how prudence works and how it's hopefully made me more wise over time. You know, maybe occasionally sharing some of my follies, but also how it's helped me understand how prudence works. Does that make sense? So a lot of it's going to come out of what's shaped me to understand prudence. And prudence is the first of the four cardinal virtues, not just because we're tackling it first, but because it's the key to the other three. You can't enact the other three virtues without doing so prudently. So, for example, one of the other virtues is fortitude. Okay, courage. You need prudence to inform courage so that you don't do something just reckless and stupid because it's courageous. I think the classic literary example of this, if you've read the Chronicles of Narnia, is Reepicheep the mouse. And Reepicheep is a valiant mouse, full of courage. So much so that he wants to fight dragons and giants. And his friends routinely have to keep him out of some battles or he'll get killed because he is just a mouse. And so he doesn't have prudence informing his fortitude. Okay? You need prudence to inform justice so that you can act justly in proportion and not like King Saul, who was going to put Jonathan to death for breaking a command he didn't even know existed. Is that proportionate justice? I think we would all say no. In fact, Saul's own men said no, and they prevented him from carrying it out. You need prudence to inform temperance so that you act in a self-controlled way, but not in a way, not with such severe asceticism to where you're doing something that has the appearance of wisdom, but instead it has no value in stopping the indulgence of the flesh, as it says in Colossians 2:23. So you need prudence to inform all the other virtues. C.S. Lewis kind of defined prudence this way. He says, prudence means practical common sense, taking the trouble to think out what you are doing and what is likely to come of it. Christ wants a child's heart, but a grown-up's head. He wants us to be simple, single-minded, affectionate, and teachable, as good children are, but he also wants every bit of intelligence we have to be alert at its job and in first-class fighting trim. Okay? A robust definition of prudence from Lewis. A little shorter definition, this is from a Christian author named Mark Horn. He says, wisdom is the skill of living your life without a solution. So wisdom or prudence is the skill of living your life without a solution. And I found that to be very helpful, a very helpful definition for me, because that informed something else that I had read that just helped me think about life. So has anybody ever heard of Seth Godin? Anybody know who Seth Godin is? He's a popular writer and blogger. He writes a lot about marketing, product management, things like that. And in one of his books, Godin says that by nature, a problem has a solution. So if you have a problem, then there is a solution somewhere out there to that problem. But if your problem doesn't have a solution, then it's not actually a problem. It's a situation. And situations are different from problems. You manage situations differently than you try to solve problems. So an example, if your car dies and you have to replace it, for most of us, that is a problem. And to solve that problem, you have to think about, okay, how am I going to replace it? How am I going to finance it? Where am I going to buy it? What's my budget? And so on. But for most of us, by the end of the whole thing, we're driving something else. And the problem has been solved, right? Sometimes we have big problems, but if they're truly problems, then we have an inkling that somewhere out there is an actual solution, and we need to work toward it so that we can solve that problem. But let's take a relationship with a spouse or a child or a friend. Relationships are built over time, and they never finally arrive at done. Right? Relationships develop over time. They never finally arrive at a fixed, finished point. You don't reach a point where a relationship is beyond change. So Patrick and I are very close friends. But there's always the potential that there could be something that causes strain in our relationship. That potential is always there as long as we both live and are friends. My kids are all under the age of 20. I've not arrived at a point in relationship with them where things will never fluctuate or change. I hope that the relationship will always be good, but there's a long way to go in those relationships. And a strained relationship is not something that can be solved with a four-step problem-solving method, right? That's a situation that is ongoing. There's no silver bullet that can make any relationship exactly right. Does that make sense? It's a situation, it's something that has to be navigated and managed. Or think of dysfunction in your workplace. If you work in some place that's really dysfunctional, there's no one single problem that can be solved that will make it a great place to work. There are all kinds of different things going on, and how are you going to navigate in that, and how are you going to manage that situation? So again, Mark Horn, wisdom is the skill of living your life without a solution. It's helpful for those situations where we don't exactly know what the answer is, and there may not even be an answer to find. Does that make sense so far? Okay. So I have some just specific points about prudence. I think I have four or five. And the first one is related to what I was just talking about, that prudence helps you navigate where there is no map. Okay? Prudence helps you navigate where there is no map, when you don't know where the fixed endpoints are or if they even exist. So I want you to put yourself in this scenario. I want you to imagine you woke up this morning and you didn't wake up in your bed. Instead, you woke up on hard ground. And as you opened your eyes and looked above you, you saw treetops framing a clear blue sky. And as you sat up and looked around, you saw trees everywhere. Okay? You have no idea where you are. You have no idea how you got there. You don't know if anybody is with you or if anybody is coming for you. So is this a problem or a solution or a situation, do you think? Probably a situation, because there is no there is no solution in mind. You don't even know where you are. You don't even know what's going on. Okay? Now, maybe a couple of days from there, after wandering around, you get to a coast and you see a ship in the distance. Then you have a problem of trying to figure out how to get the ship's attention to come get to you. And you start working toward that solution. But until then, your primary goal is probably just to stay alive. To figure out, how do I find food? How do I find shelter? How do I keep myself from getting killed by whatever is out here that might be malevolent? Okay? You have a series of short-term goals to try to help you navigate until you can get somewhere where there's actually a solution to a problem. And prudence helps you navigate where there's no map. Because our lives are a lot of times like that. Our lives a lot of times feel like being dropped into something and we don't exactly know, you know, where it is that we're heading. We've been promised that we're going to spend eternity with the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen?
Amen.
And hallelujah. But there's a lot of living to do before we get there. Okay? There's a lot that's still going to go on, and a lot that's going to prepare us for living there. And prudence isn't concerned with the ultimate ends of life. It's concerned with how to reach those ultimate ends of life, how to keep going, how to navigate. So I look forward, I look to the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. But this life is important too, in all of its elements. In my daily life, in my relationships, this life is important too, even as I look toward that ultimate end. And becoming prudent means becoming somebody who effortlessly sees danger and avoids it, and who effortlessly sees good opportunities and acts upon them. Okay? So as I navigate in this life, I'm aware of danger and I avoid it, and I'm aware of good things and I move toward them. Does that make sense so far? Okay. So I know not to look at internet pornography. I know that. I know that that it's a sin. I know that it's a perversion and a corruption and grasping after an illusion, and it's something that God does not intend for us. But knowing that is not in itself sufficient. I also need to have the prudence to be able to arrange my life in such a way that mitigates the temptation. Does that make sense? It's not just about knowing it. But it's about actually arranging my life in a way that I will not move toward that. When I think about Solomon, you know, Solomon fell away from the Lord. It doesn't say that God took his wisdom away. Solomon was wise until he died, but he stopped obeying the Lord. He was disobedient. And he used his wisdom really toward bad ends. So I need to make sure that I'm a man of prudence to effortlessly arrange my life in a way that avoids danger and moves toward the good. Matthew 10:16, Jesus said, "Behold, I am sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. So be wise as serpents and innocent as doves." So wise as serpents and innocent as doves. What does that mean? I think to be as wise as a serpent means to know where all the dangers are, to know where the vulnerabilities are, to know where your vulnerabilities are. But to be innocent as a dove means to avoid actually entering into those. You don't have to know the danger from the inside. You know where it is, and then you avoid it. Okay? That's what it means to be wise as a serpent and innocent as doves. Proverbs 22:3 says, "The prudent see danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it." So that was the first point, is that prudence helps us to navigate where there is no map. Second thing is that prudence reckons with reality. Prudence takes reality as a given and doesn't try to get around it. Prudence does not deal in wishful thinking. It has no use for wishful thinking. As one writer puts it, facts are stubborn things. Facts are stubborn things, and prudence does not try to get around those facts. Prudence does not say, maybe I'll be the exception. Maybe this time I'll be the exception, even though all the other cases before went in this particular way. Maybe I'll be the exception. So how many of you ever doubt that you have prudence? How many of you ever doubt that you're wise? Okay. Okay. All right. All right. Well, I appreciate that. I want to encourage you, though. If you ever doubt that you have prudence, I want you to ask yourself if you've ever given your bank account number to a wealthy Nigerian prince offering $1 million as a great blessing to you. Have you ever done that, Nick? He's thinking. No, have you ever done this? Just delete the email. Okay, all right. Well, so be encouraged. You've never done that. Have you ever gotten such an email? Yeah, or somebody like that. There's all kinds. Okay, well, if you've ever gotten that kind of email.
Sorry, the whole taking reality is a given. Yeah. Get around
okay. So if you've ever gotten such an email and you've never actually acted upon it, you do have some prudence then. Because Proverbs 14:15 says, "The simple believes everything, but the prudent gives thought to his steps." And so prudence allows us to navigate a simple situation like that. We see the email and we think, you know, I would really like it if there was somebody who wanted to bless me with $1 million. But the odds are this is a scam, and so I'm just going to delete the email. Reality is not that strangers don't just give people $1 million. That does happen sometimes. The reality is it's a known thing that those kind of emails are scams. It's a known thing. And so based on all the cases before and all the internet knowledge that such things are scams, you don't say, well, maybe I'll be the exception. And maybe this time there is actually somebody who wants to give me $1 million. You say, based on everything that's come before, I know this is probably a scam. Although when I was looking it up, I saw an article that went out 2 years ago that $700,000 was lost to people who gave people their bank account after getting such emails. So, I mean, those scams do, unfortunately, still work, as ridiculous as they are. Some people do still think that they will be the exception. Okay, along the lines of reckoning with reality and not thinking that we will be the exception, prudence allows you to navigate your health. Okay, hopefully you have a long way to go in the body that you have. And if you're going to let prudence drive the car, then that means reckoning with reality. Okay? Reckoning with reality about how you treat your body. And a lot of times it really does come down to eating less, eating healthier, and exercising. As boring as that is, and as many fad diets and other plans as there are, a lot of times it really does just come down to eating less, eating healthier, and exercising. So, it's boring, but it's true. You see cake and ice cream. And prudence says, pick one. Don't eat both. Pick one. Okay? Or you're thinking about what to eat, and you're considering there's grilled chicken on salad, and there's the Wendy's Baconator. Okay? And you do the calculus, right? You see the two options, and you deliberate, and prudence says, well, we have a long way to go in this body, and we don't want high cholesterol, and we have a long way to go in this pair of pants that you just bought. And so we should take the grilled chicken salad. And a lot of times, we take the Baconator, and we think, well, maybe I'll be the exception. Maybe this will be a magic Baconator, and I won't gain any pounds, and my cholesterol won't go up, okay? So when prudence becomes an actual virtue, when it's effortless good, a lot of times we don't even go through those deliberations. And you never actually think about ordering the Baconator. And you get the grilled chicken instead because you already know this is the wise thing to do. This is the prudent thing to do to help my body. Yeah. But wisdom reckons with reality. So prudence thinks of things like the APR on a credit card, pays attention to that kind of thing, doesn't just ignore it. When I was in college, maybe it was similar when you were in college, Chad, that credit card companies used to have people on campus, and so you could go by and you could just fill out a form and you got a credit card in the mail. College students, you know, getting there, no idea. Really, and when I was in college, you know, credit cards were not as ubiquitous, and there was a little bit of a kind of a status thing if you had a credit card and such. You didn't need it just to do a lot of the things that we need now. And so these credit card companies were really preying on ignorant college students who had no idea what they were getting into and racking up all kinds of debt. So prudence pays attention to things like that. You can't navigate situations if you disregard what is real. What is an actual stubborn fact? Proverbs 17:24 says, "The discerning sets his face before wisdom, but the eyes of a fool are on the ends of the earth." The eyes of a fool are on, you know, what is imaginary, what is not actually right in front of them. Next point is that prudence calls for an open mind. Prudence calls for an open mind. Prudence resists the hot take on things. Okay? Prudence recognizes that you'll probably never have all of the information. And so it's unwise to form a strong opinion unless you really need to make a decision.
That's good.
A lot of times we have strong opinions about things that really don't matter very much at all. and our lives become somewhat stressful because of that. There's a guy, he was the president of the University of Southern California for about 10 years, named Steve Sample. And he wrote a book that I really like. And he calls this thinking gray. And the essence of thinking gray is this: you don't form an opinion about an important matter until you've heard all the relevant facts and arguments, or until circumstances force you to form an opinion without recourse to all the facts. Okay, so you don't immediately form an opinion about things unless you have to. In that moment, you really have to. You don't always have to have an opinion about everything, even important things. So, you know, just thinking about two areas where I think of this is receiving the news or hearing the news and in meeting people. Okay? So the first one, thinking about the news, there's no such thing as an unbiased news program or an unbiased news article. There's always some kind of bias implicit in there. Social media is the same. And a lot of times reporting the news now is about clicks and keeping people on the page. It just is. That's the way the business model works for news outlets. After the Omicron variant became news, I would have CNN's live updates. I would just refresh on my phone periodically to see what, you know, the latest live update was. And like every third update was some organization, whether the World Health Organization or the CDC or the president, saying, there's just a lot we don't know. And that was the news update, was there's just a lot we don't know. And it's just designed to keep you on the page, keep you refreshing, you know, kind of the promise of new updates. And because they have to put something on there, they say, there's just a lot that we don't know. So try thinking gray when you come across the news. This helps me to not have to form an opinion about everything that I read. So, you know, yesterday, 2,800 new cases of COVID in Kentucky, positivity rate 9.2%, all the numbers going up. Okay, so I read that. Am I supposed to panic? Am I supposed to worry? Am I supposed to think about what the implications are going to be? Am I supposed to think about how that will impact things in the church or my job? Am I supposed to get rigid within myself and say, I'm not going to accept any lockdown? Or I can read that and say, oh, so that's where the numbers are these days, and not have a definite, strong opinion about it. I think this is prudence in action, to be able to process something like that and just kind of leave it gray, just kind of leave it without having a strong attachment to it. Because prior to receiving that piece of news, I was already trying to navigate different things going on in my life, things much more important in my life mm-hmm. than when that piece of news came in. And if I react to every piece of news that comes in with some kind of strong opinion, then I'm just distracted all over the place. I don't have that kind of emotional energy, and neither do you. There's no need to get sidetracked by things that you can't directly influence anyway. So you read some, you know, sports article. I don't know. There were three players on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers who faked their COVID vaccine cards. Okay, now you could read that and get really outraged about it, but why? What's the point? It has nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with me. And there are all kinds of situations like that. Just the inputs that we receive from life. The other thing is meeting people. Okay, you don't have to decide right away whether you like a person that you just met. You don't right away have to form an opinion about somebody that you just met. You don't have to have any opinion at all. I find a lot of times when somebody visits church for the first time, you just begin making observations and you begin forming a composite, right? I think we do this unconsciously, but it begins to happen. And so, okay, they came with so-and-so. Are they dating? Are they in some kind of relationship? Does anybody know about that? Or somebody comes in, their clothes aren't very nice. Are they poor? Will they ask for money? Or somebody, you get done talking to somebody and say, they talked a lot. Are they lonely? Are they needy? Should I let somebody else kind of invite them over for dinner first? Or you think, wow, they have quite a few kids. I bet they homeschool. And I wonder who they homeschool with. Or they wore a cowboy hat. I like that. So you begin making all these observations and forming a composite. And most of the time, you couldn't be more wrong. Most of my first impressions are way off. Way off. Not the cowboy hat thing, though. And so, again, this is prudence in action. You begin making those associations, those observations, that composite. And prudence says, just suspend that. Don't put a lot of weight in that.
That's good.
Keep going forward. You know, make the invite. You know, befriend them. Don't adjust what you're doing just based on this first impression that you've made. Just keep going forward. Prudence interacts with the person knowing that much more is to be revealed through time and patience and empathy and hospitality. This is from a novel by a writer named Amor Towles. the character thinks, what can a first impression tell us about someone we've just met for a minute in the lobby of a hotel? For that matter, what can a first impression tell us about anyone? Why, no more than a chord can tell us about Beethoven, or a brushstroke about Botticelli. By their very nature, human beings are so capricious, so complex, so delightfully contradictory, that they deserve not only our consideration, but our reconsideration, and our unwavering determination to withhold our opinion until we have engaged with them in every possible setting at every possible hour. Now, you can't forever suspend some judgments, but I think it does say that we can hold our own judgments with suspicion, or at least provisionally until more facts are accrued. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm, that's good.
Okay. Next point is that prudence is not a virtue if you don't act, if you don't act upon it. So we may be able to reckon with reality and deliberate among the options and determine, you know, what's the best course of action. But for prudence to be a virtue, you have to act upon it. You have to actually not order the Baconator. Okay? Not just know that you shouldn't, but actually not order it. Proverbs 19:24 says, the sluggard buries his hand in the dish and will not even bring it back to his mouth. And that's a picture of knowing what the good thing is, or knowing where the danger is, but just kind of plunging forward anyway, not actually enacting the wisdom. Many of us know what the prudent thing is to do, but we lack the character to actually do it and to follow through on it. You know that it's unwise to blow the whole afternoon playing video games instead of studying. You've reckoned with reality. You've weighed your options. You've decided that that's the case. But prudence is completed only when you actually enact it and you do the prudent thing. If you blow the afternoon playing video games, then you're obviously not prudent. A writer who's thought about the virtues very much, named Joseph Pieper, wrote, the virtue of prudence is dependent upon the constant readiness to ignore the self. The virtue of prudence is dependent upon the constant readiness to ignore the self. Because the self, obviously, most of the time wants to go against what is the wise thing to do. Our flesh tends to get in the way of doing what we know to be prudent. Okay. Rounding third, heading for home. How do you acquire prudence and make it an effortless good? There are a lot of ways, and I just want to touch on really one. But before I get to that one thing, one obvious thing is what I just said, is to do the prudent thing after you know what it is. That's a way to grow and to make it a virtue. Most of the time, we don't even need to deliberate that much. Most of the time we know what it is, we just don't want to do it. But as you enact the prudent thing, your character changes, and then you begin to do the prudent thing in other areas of your life. It's kind of, you get compounded interest from it. And so you do the prudent thing, you actually enact upon it, and then that begins to show up in other areas of your life. And you reliably become the kind of person who does the prudent thing. So that's kind of the obvious one. How do you grow? You know, the Bible says the first thing in acquiring wisdom is to get wisdom, which it's like, well, how does that work? Seems like a loop. But as you do the prudent thing, you grow in your ability to keep doing the prudent thing in other areas of life. But the one that I mostly want to focus on is probably one you wouldn't think of, and that's why I wanted to bring it out. It's to read widely, especially fiction. Okay? Read widely, especially fiction, because our database of personal experience is too small, and we need the experiences of others to inform our database of what's prudent and what's not. And sometimes fictional experiences can really shape us and lead us toward truth. Does that make sense? We can gain a lot from reading about the prudent and imprudent actions of fictional characters. And a great example of prudence in action, of navigating through complexity, that I want to spend a little time talking about, is the Greek figure of Odysseus. Has anybody ever read the Odyssey? Raise your hand if you've read the Odyssey, Homer's Odyssey. Okay, fair amount. So When the Odyssey opens, Odysseus, who's a Greek hero, he's been gone from home for 20 years. He spent 10 years fighting in the Trojan War and then 10 years trying to get back home, repeatedly frustrated along the way from doing so. And in the previous epic of Homer called the Iliad, the hero is a guy named Achilles, and he's a hero because he is unmatchable as a fighter. At one point, he emerges on the battlefield and he lets out a war cry, and it kills 12 of the Trojans. Just a war cry. He doesn't actually fight. He unleashes a war cry, kills 12 Trojans. Okay, so that's his prowess. He's a hero because of his unmatchability as a fighter. But Odysseus is a hero by virtue of his craftiness, of his ability to navigate complex situations. He might be the wiliest figure in all of literature. And his goal is to get home to his wife and son in Ithaca. But before he gets there, he repeatedly has to face challenge after challenge after challenge, all of which call for quick decisions that are a matter of life and death. And here's the thing. The divine council of the Greek gods want him to get home. But even though they're behind him, he still has to face challenge after challenge. In one situation, he's trapped in the cave of a cyclops, he and his men. And the cyclops has already killed several of his men and eaten them. Okay, a cyclops is a giant monster with one eye. And at one point, the cyclops asks Odysseus his name. And anybody know what name Odysseus gives him?
Ulysses?
Nope. Nobody. He says, my name is Nobody. And later, after Odysseus has jabbed a fiery stake into the Cyclops' eye while it was asleep, the Cyclops shouts for help, and there are all these neighboring Cyclopses around. And the Cyclops shouts for help, and they come lumbering over, and they say, what's the matter? What's the matter? And the Cyclops says, Nobody is killing me. And the Cyclops will say, well, then shut up. You should call out for Zeus for help because, you know, something's going on with you. We don't know what it is. And Odysseus laughs in his heart because of his stratagem to give him the name Nobody. But he can't outright kill the Cyclops because if he does, then they'll all starve to death because there's this giant rock slab that's blocking the way out of the cave. And so the Cyclops is blinded and angry, the Cyclops perches itself at the front of the cave, ready to grab anybody who comes running past. But there are sheep in the cave, and so Odysseus and his men tie themselves to the underbellies of the sheep, and that's how they escape the cave of the Cyclops, because when the sheep have to go out to graze, then the men are underneath. And that's Odysseus' shrewd way of being able to escape the cave. And so it's one thing after another. But when he gets back to Ithaca, the situation is not over. Because he gets home and he finds out that there are all these suitors wanting to marry his wife because everybody figures Odysseus is dead. He's been gone for 20 years, 10 years after the war has ended. And these suitors have a vested interest in Odysseus being dead because they want one of them to marry Penelope, Odysseus' wife. And so Odysseus can't just come strutting in and saying, I'm home. He can't do that, or they'll just kill him on the spot because they would rather he be dead. And so, what's he going to do? How is he going to manage this situation? And what happens is that the goddess Athena transforms his body to make him old and ugly and decrepit. And he puts on rags and he assumes the disguise of a beggar. And he goes begging at the doors of his own palace so that he can gain intel of what's going on, what servants are still loyal to him and who isn't. Is his wife faithful? How many of these suitors are there? And how, you know, how good are they at fighting? Who would actually be on his side? So he assumes the disguise of a beggar in order to get intel. And as he does, these suitors repeatedly abuse him. And they mock him and they make fun of him. And they mistreat him at his own palace. Now, does this remind you of any other story where there's a rightful king in disguise who's being mistreated by those who should be loyal to him? It's the story of Jesus, the rightful king, who came to his own and his own knew him not. But by sticking to his roots, Odysseus is able to get access to the palace. He devises a way to hide the weapons, and he plots and he gathers other conspirators. And he never uses his real name, and he keeps all of his information very close to the chest until he actually has to let other people in. And in the end, he cleanses the house of the suitors. But even then, the situation's not over, because he knows that the families of the suitors are going to want revenge. And there's a lot more of them than there were actually of the suitors. So the whole story of the Odyssey is one thing after another. It's him constantly managing a situation. There is no one problem to solve. And so I think he's a great example that as you read about Odysseus, you see, with, you know, you see prudence put into action as he tries to get closer and closer to managing the situation and to saving his own life. Does that make sense? And there are all kinds of examples in literature where we can learn from the experiences of others, and it just informs our database as we come across situations. Okay, a couple quick things in conclusion. This is Joseph Pieper again. The man who does good follows the lines of an architectural plan which has not been conceived by himself, and which he does not understand as a whole, not in all of its parts. The architectural plan is revealed to man from moment to moment. In each case, he sees only a tiny segment of it through a narrow crack. Never, so long as he is in the state of being on the way, will the concrete architectural plan of his own self become visible to him in its rounded and final shape. In other words, we see our lives largely in outline, and we see things a little bit at a time. We don't see the whole picture. Ecclesiastes 3:11 says, God has made everything beautiful for its own time. He has planted eternity in the human heart. But even so, people cannot see the whole scope of God's work from beginning to end. We see our lives in outline and a little bit at a time. And prudence helps us navigate away from danger and toward the good. So I want to leave you with a couple of questions. And we can kick some of these questions around, or just questions you might want to jot down, think about, journal, pray about. First one, what in your life feels like a problem in need of a solution, but is really a situation that calls for wisdom? This might be a strained relationship, might be a health condition, might be something going on at work. But what feels like a problem in need of a solution, but it's really a situation? And there is no one thing that's going to resolve it, make it all go away, make it all go back to normal. Next one, how good are you at reckoning with reality? When you make decisions, do you account for reality? Third, who do you know that deserves a reconsideration? Something beyond your first impressions or the impressions that you've made. Who deserves a reconsideration? Do you tend to know the prudent thing but not do it? Do you lack the character to do the prudent thing? And then finally, do you read fiction to access lives and experience beyond your own? And if not, how could you start?